friends and colleagues, and welcome to episode 114 of Dermasphere, the podcast by dermatologists, for dermatologists, and for the dermatologically curious. I am one of your hosts. My name is Luke Johnson. I am a pediatric dermatologist and general dermatologist with the University of Utah. And every 2 weeks, Dermasphere comes to your ears with discussions of some of the latest research in the world of clinical dermatology, so you can feel up to date just by listening to us, we hope. And if you have listened to this podcast before, you are probably expecting me to introduce Michelle Tarbox at this time, but I'm not going to. She had a scheduling conflict, but will be joining us a little bit later. But good news, you don't have to hear me drone on by myself. I've got a guest here with me today. This is Dr. Julia Curtis. Dr. Curtis, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Luke. Excited to be here.
We're excited to have you. Do you want to start by introducing yourself?
Sure. I'm Dr. Julia Curtis with the University of Utah Department of Dermatology. I am an assistant professor here, and I have a subspecialty in pigmented lesions, mole mapping, and total body photography.
And how would you describe your fingernails?
My fingernails are unmanicured at this point.
Many dermatologists seem to have unmanicured fingernails for various reasons, and you drew my attention to one article that has been getting some attention in the lay press that we thought we'd talk about today. This article is out of Nature Communications and is called DNA Damage and Somatic Mutations in Mammalian Cells After Irradiation with a Nail Polish Dryer. Authors include Maria Zivagui and Ludmil Alexandrov out of San Diego. So, Dr. Curtis, I know you looked through this article. I'm sure you did more than look through it because you wrote a little piece about it in one of our newsletters. Can you give us the broad strokes?
Sure. The broad strokes for this article is that this team out of San Diego and University of Pittsburgh, I believe, took some mouse cells and human cells and basically irradiated them with UVA and to see what would happen in this cell line of mouse and human cells to see if there's mutations, damage to the DNA, and looked at reactive oxygen species. They are trying to get an idea of what could be happening to our own cells as we put our fingernails into a UV nail dryer.
So my nails are similarly unmanicured, but my understanding is that there are plenty of people in the world who, in fact, do lots of interesting things to their fingernails. And apparently one of those things is to put on some kind of nail polish gel. I presume there's lots of different kinds of nail polish. This must be one specific kind that requires it to be dried or cured in some fashion. And a common way to do that is with ultraviolet A radiation. So, and correct me if I'm wrong about any of this, Dr. Curtis, but it sounds like there are specific devices that a lot of nail salons have that emit this ultraviolet radiation. And I looked them up online. They kind of look like little tiny igloos or little tiny caves, and you stick your fingers in there for like 10 minutes and UVA irradiates your nails. And as it happens, anything else you have stuck in there, like your fingers. And after about 10 minutes, that gel is cured, and then you can remove your hand and enjoy looking at your cool looking nails. Does that sound about right?
That is about right. So basically, there's acrylic nails, gel nails, and in this nail polish. And in this nail polish, when it's irradiated by UV, it causes it to cure and to harden. And so you don't have to wait that really long time after you get nail polish applied to be able to put your socks on or go about your day without ruining your brand new nail polish. And so what you do is you actually put it in, they put on a layer, you put your fingers in the nail lamps for about a minute at a time, about three times at a go, two to three minutes for about 2 to 3 times. And so it ends up being about 10 minutes in length, but your fingers don't go in for 10 minutes total at one time. And so, yes, basically people are getting this done about every 2 weeks. So every 2 weeks, your nails and the skin around your nails are being exposed to UV radiation.
And it looks like there are case reports of skin cancers of and around the nails in young women that are, you know, possibly slash presumably attributable to this sort of approach. And I think that inspired these researchers. And they got these cell lines, and I've not a basic scientist. I don't know how you get a cell line, if it's on a petri dish or whatever, but they irradiated them with the same kind of ultraviolet radiation that are used in these nail lamps. And indeed, they found that it caused mutations and reactive oxygen species, changes in the DNA and stuff like that. And so the implication is that even though this wasn't a human model, we still should at least be cautious, perhaps more cautious than we currently are.
Yes, that is correct. So they did take, so this is in vitro. So it's not, you know, we don't know how exactly how the interplay is between, you know, your in vivo cells, the cells on your skin, I mean, on your fingers that you put in the nails, in the nail lamps versus this in vitro line. But what they did see was damage to these cells. And so it's hard to always extrapolate, you know, this in vitro line to what is actually happening on our own skin. But it's cause for concern. And as they've indicated, that there should be more research done on the effects of these UV nail lamps. And there are these published case reports. I published a case report of a patient that had more squamous cell skin cancers around their fingernails and toenails. And we hypothesized that maybe it's because she was getting these UV gel nails every several weeks for 10 to 15 years about. And actually, I was one of the original researchers that actually put these UV measuring devices into nail lamps in Salt Lake City. And we measured the UV doses that were occurring from these UV nail lamps. And we published that as well, showing that there was very high intensity of the UV radiation in a very short period of time. And it basically equated to about the OSHA limits for a worker for outside for 8 hours. So in less than 10 minutes, you're getting 8 hours worth of sunlight in a very short period of time. And we are worried about that intensity. And that has caused also some other people to do further research.
Yikes. So if I still want to have my cool gel nails, what's the solution? Are there other ways to cure them? Can I put sunscreen all over my fingers ahead of time?
Yes. So what we've recommended is that you can always put a good UV sun, a good blocker, like whether it's mineral or chemical. I prefer zinc and titanium. And you can actually buy UV sun gloves. You can cut off the fingertips. And so before your fingers go into these UV nail lamps, you can have sunblock on, you can put gloves on. But the other thing you could do is if you wanted to pivot, they also make very cool, you could, they make very cool stickers. And so what you can do is you can take a picture of your nails, send them into an online website, and they can actually make stickers for in the shape of your nails. And they work very well. And actually some of our dermatology residents have been doing that, and I can't tell the difference. Or you could just use the original nail polish that doesn't require curing. And lastly, they do make some of these nail lamps with LEDs. And so that remits much less UV radiation.
Nail stickers? Is there a specific website or company that you use?
I haven't used it, but it's very searchable online. And let me see. Yeah.
All right. Just wondered if you had a specific recommendation, but we can track it down.
Okay.
So a couple other points. So we mentioned in vitro doesn't necessarily translate, but obviously there's reason for concern. But some things that would limit its applicability to actual human skin. So if you've got a line of cells that you're irradiating, those don't have the cornified layer of the epidermis, which presumably offers sun protection for us. And also, they say that in vitro systems may accumulate non-physiological background mutations, which will be different from the background mutations found in normal human skin. Kind of interesting. They also go over some of the sort of basic photobiology, and I'll just hit it briefly. Michelle's not here, as I mentioned, so we don't have the pimping bell, but ding, ding. So in a way, it's like not surprising that if you irradiate cells with ultraviolet A radiation, that they accumulate mutations. Like, it's kind of a duh thing, almost. It's like a tanning bed for your hands, as far as I can tell. But as a reminder, ultraviolet light is electromagnetic radiation with a wavelength between 10 and 400 nanometers. Wavelengths below 280 nanometers are blocked by the Earth's stratospheric ozone. And so ultraviolet light that reaches Earth's surface is generally between 280 and 400 nanometers. And scientists once upon a time have divided those up between UVB, which is 280 to 350 nanometers, and UVA, which is 315 to 400 nanometers. And both are considered carcinogenic. The UVB is more directly carcinogenic in that it affects the DNA directly, whereas UVA seems to be indirectly carcinogenic in that it creates reactive oxygen species that then in turn damage the DNA. So UVA is officially a carcinogenic environmental toxin. And so if you're sticking your hands into a big bowl of environmental toxin, perhaps we shouldn't be surprised that there are occasional problems doing so. That's the upshot. Dr. Curtis, thanks for joining us. Anything else you want our listeners to know or you want to add before we let you go?
Yes. So one of the websites for these stick-on nails are, it's called colorstreet.com. So you can check that out, and instead of irradiating your fingers, you can try these new nail stickers and have beautiful nails.
Hashtag not sponsored. Well, thanks for joining us, Dr. Curtis. We'll catch you next time.
Thank you, Dr. Johnson. Have a great day.
Hey, look, everybody. It's Michelle. Michelle, are you feeling better?
So much better. I'm feeling a lot more like myself. My voice is back. The world is a good place.
Wow. And it's only been like 10 minutes.
I know. It's this magical new miracle cold remedy that I'm taking. Let me tell you all about it. Just kidding.
Yeah. Is it just like $1,000 per dose? Because that would track.
You know, it's this very special vitamin mix. I'm selling it on Instagram if you want to check out my profile.
Not really, listeners.
That's a joke. That's a joke.
As far as I know.
Nope,
okay.
That's a joke.
Let's move on. I want to talk about cantharidin for molluscum. So this is an article out of the American Journal of Clinical Dermatology. It was published a couple years ago, 2021, but spoilers, the drug device combination that it describes has just recently been approved for the treatment of molluscum in this country.
Huzzah!
And the title is Pooled Results of Two Randomized Phase 3 Trials Evaluating VP-102, a drug-device combination product containing cantharidin 0.7% for the treatment of molluscum contagiosum. Authors include Larry Eichenfield, hi Larry, and Melissa Olivadotti. So finally, a randomized controlled trial for molluscum. And FDA approved, like I mentioned. This is sponsored by industry, of course, and has some great pediatric dermatologists involved. And I feel like for the past 3 or 4 years, I've been seeing like ads for the company and the Society for Pediatric Dermatology meetings and stuff like that. So they've been working on this for a while. So good job getting it approved, guys. This is a drug device combination product that contains cantharidin. And you can Google what it looks like. The brand name of this stuff is... it's spelled Y-C-A-N-T-H. So I presume that's pronounced Y-canth, or it could be E-canth. I'm not sure who came up with the name, because it's like, Y-canth? Well, why not canth? It's kind of confusing. Anywho, if you look it up online, you'll see that the applicators are like these little plastic syringes with an angle on the end, so you can sort of, you know, crush the little tiny glass vial within the bulb, and then you can sort of carefully drip it onto the molluscum lesions. And we have used cantharidin in pediatric dermatology and dermatology and primary care to treat molluscum and warts. We've been using it for a long time, like decades. Despite the fact that we don't know exactly how it works, we have this idea that it creates a blister, and the way I describe it is we hope that when the blister peels off, it kind of takes the wart away with it. But there are, of course, some challenges, including access, including, you know, varying by state, because usually this has to be compounded and usually they're multi-use vials or bottles. And some institutions or some states like have prescriptions against multi-use bottles. I don't know what it's like in Texas. I feel like I remember using multi-use bottles down there.
It kind of depends on who's paying attention and who you ask.
Okay, well, here it seems to depend specifically on, like, which clinic you're in. I think, like, hospital-based clinics can do it, but others can't, or something like that. Not totally sure. Also, the authors of this study point out a lack of consistent formulation of cantharidin due to the compounding process, a lack of trials, until now, and a lack of consistent technique. So, for example, when I was learning how to do this in residency, we would always occlude the wort or molluscum with, like, a piece of tape or a Band-Aid. But when I read the textbooks, it said, specifically, don't occlude them. So some people do, some people don't. I think occluding it makes it stronger, and you can sort of tailor your approach that way to the individual patient or the individual lesion. But anywho, this product and these trials aim to address all those issues. This single little applicator contains cantharidin at 0.7%, as well as three other ingredients. Acetone, gentian violet, so you don't accidentally treat the surrounding skin, you can see where your medicine is, and a compound called denatonium benzoate, which is, quote, one of the bitterest substances on the planet, and is there to deter ingestion. I don't know who might be thinking of eating this stuff, though, especially as apparently intended to be delivered by healthcare providers. So this isn't a medicine that you prescribe and your patient goes and picks it up at the pharmacy and then applies it to themselves. This is a carton of applicators that you keep in your office. And when you say, hey, you've got some molluscum, this is approved. Would you like me to treat them? You go to your stock room and you get this stuff and then you treat it. Maybe it's to prevent the 2-year-olds from licking it off of the backs of their hands or something. I guess it's not a bad idea. I just don't know anyone who's ever been tempted to eat cantharidin. So just like current cantharidin or cryotherapy, you store it in your clinic. Cost is probably going to be the biggest issue, though. It looks like it's about $8,500 for a box of 12 applicators, which ends up being about $700 per applicator, which presumably has enough medicine in it to treat a single patient one time. So this study here is the pooled analysis of two different double-blind randomized controlled trials with a total of about 500 patients, age 2 plus, almost all of them are pediatric, comparing this YCANTH stuff to vehicle, which contained all those other ingredients and didn't contain the cantharidin. Patients were treated every 3 weeks for up to 4 treatments and then reassessed again a few weeks after the last treatment. And every, quote, treatable molluscum lesion on the surface of the skin was treated, including inflamed lesions, those in the genital area, and in patients with severe or with active atopic dermatitis. Participants were instructed to wash with soap and water 24 hours later. So this is, again, perhaps a practice difference thing. I was always taught to tell people to wash it 4 hours later. These guys all did 24 hours later.
Wow.
So at day 84, 50% of patients in the treatment group had complete clearance of their molluscum. In the vehicle group, it was 15. So quite a bit better, but still 50% complete clearance after 4 treatments and 3 months. In addition, as time went on, total number of lesions decreased more in the drug group and an increasing number of patients had complete clearance. The adverse effects are what you would guess if you put cantharidin on people. There was pain, blistering, and scabbing. Molluscum, of course, can stick around for a long time. I feel like I was taught it was an average of 6 months, but this study reports previous literature suggesting that 13 months is the average length of time in pediatric patients. In addition, in this study, the molluscum lesions had been already present for an average of about 4 months before they started treatment, and plenty of patients, both in the treatment and the vehicle group, still had lesions after another 3 months. So it's tough. And they report the incubation time is 2 to 8 weeks, which I wasn't quite sure, but I think I sort of guessed it was around that time. And in terms of contagion, you know, that is its last name, molluscum contagiosum, apparently about 42% of kids spread molluscum to a sibling. I was honestly surprised it was that low. My personal feeling is that a lot of kids get just one or two lesions that go unnoticed, or they don't actually develop clinical lesions, but their immune system just jumps on the virus. So if you have a 3-year-old who's had molluscum for 8 months, I'm like, it's almost 100% that everyone else in the family has been exposed. So if they haven't developed lesions, they're probably immune. So that's the deal. That's the trials that got this stuff approved. And molluscum is indeed a drag, but it is important to remember that it's not dangerous and it spontaneously resolves.
The components are very interesting. The percentage of the cantharidin is the same that's available commercially that you probably have in your clinic right now, that 0.7%. The gentian violet is a nice addition because of the ability to visualize where the substance is applied, but also it is antimicrobial. And so I wonder if that had any additive benefit with that. And then that denatonium benzoate, that is what's used in the sort of nail lacquers that are produced to help kind of deter people from nail biting. So it's not it's a pretty good design, honestly. I think that you're correct that the cost might be prohibitive, but the combination of those things is intelligent.
Yeah, I think it's a good idea. And of course, we all know that even though molluscum is not dangerous and goes away on its own, it certainly can be pretty annoying. It spreads, it's contagious, it can become inflamed, it can leave little scars. But I think that I speak for most pediatric dermatologists and probably most healthcare professionals in this country that I think it is a good idea in most cases to just leave it alone. And I am not sure that this study changes my opinion on that, but it is still excellent to have a real RCT for molluscum and to get some more data about the disease's natural history. It will be interesting to see what happens in terms of cost. It's hard to imagine clinics, insurance companies, or even really motivated parents to fork out $700 for a single treatment. These multi-use bottles of cantharidin that I think most of us have around, the brand is Cantharone, cost about $75 to $100 and can probably treat at least 10 patients. The Cantharone itself is 0.7% cantharidin, like you mentioned. They also have a product called Cantharone Plus, which is a little stronger, 1%, and also adds pitophyllotoxin and salicylic acid. And of course, there's cryo and just waiting.
Yeah. In older people, curettage works really well. I don't do curettage for small children because I don't think holding children down for extended periods of time is conducive to good relationships with healthcare. But for older patients, the curettage works really well and they just sort of pop out. They don't even really leave a scar when you do that.
Well, I really like the idea behind this medicine. And I think the cost is I think it's going to be prohibitive, but we'll see. Maybe they'll come up with some way to make it affordable and our patients can access it.
Well, thinking about something that started out very, very inaffordable, very inaccessible due to cost and has become much more affordable and much more mainstay, let's talk about imiquimod and lentigo maligna. How is that for a segue, Luke?
One of my favorites.
So this is a little bit of a vintage article. This is from 2018, and this is from the University of Utah. And we're going to take a little pause to honor the legacy of the senior author, Glenn Bowen, who was a Mohs surgeon at U of U, and you knew him, Luke, so I'll let you speak of him.
Yes, I didn't know him very well. Unfortunately, he passed away just about a year after I started here, but he was much beloved in the department and spent most of his career here and did some pioneering work specifically for Mohs for melanoma. So everybody who knew him really liked him a lot and had a high opinion of him. So pour one out for Glenn.
Pimping bell salute. So this article by the esteemed Glenn Bowen, a senior author and first author Jessica Donegan, looks at the rates of recurrence of lentigo maligna treated with off-label neoadjuvant topical imiquimod 5% cream prior to conservatively staged excision. And I like this title for many reasons. One of them is it sort of helps set up the definition of neoadjuvant. So for anybody who's learning in our community, neoadjuvant means that you're going to use something that's going to help treat whatever it is that you're treating before the main treatment is delivered. So adjuvant just kind of means like helping or helper. Neoadjuvant occurs before the main treatment. Adjuvant therapy happens usually after the primary therapy.
So you could say I'm an adjuvant to you because I help you make the podcast.
Yes, we are adjuvant to each other. And you are a neo-adjuvant to me because you usually pick out the articles before we record the podcast. So that's very helpful.
What about Morpheus? Was he also a neo-adjuvant?
Well, it did happen before, so perhaps the green pill is neo-adjuvant.
Also, Keanu Reeves' character was Neo. We digress significantly.
We have fallen into the Matrix. Let's get back into dermatology.
I bet Glenn Bowen would appreciate it, though. He was a guy who liked a good digression, from what I hear.
I love that plan. And, you know, Morpheus was a wise gentleman who guided people, so I like these things. So staged excision of lentigo maligna can require multiple stages and can result, of course, in significant cosmetic morbidity, especially because of where lentigo maligna likes to occur, which tends to be the head and neck. Imiquimod has been used off-label as monotherapy for lentigo maligna and may be helpful in the use of neoadjuvant therapy for staged excision as a strategy to help kind of decrease the size of the surgical margins required to confirm negative histologic margins. That's sort of the target of this study. So they wanted to examine the recurrence rate of lentigo maligna in patients treated with neoadjuvant topical imiquimod 5% cream prior to conservatively staged excisions. This was retrospective because this has been a practice in this particular institution for some period of time. So they were able to do a retrospective medical record review of 334 patients that had 345 biopsy-confirmed lentigo maligna tumors from 2004 to 2012. So of course, a few patients had more than one lentigo maligna, which is not that unusual here in beautiful sunny Lubbock, Texas. So that makes sense. These patients were treated with imiquimod prior to undergoing staged excisions at the University of Utah or at Huntsman Cancer Institute, large academic hospitals in Salt Lake City. The patients were treated off-label with 5% imiquimod 5 nights per week for 2 to 3 months. Then they had about a 2-month sort of recovery period to allow for the inflammation and the erythema and the inflammatory changes to resolve. When I was first looking at the title of this study, I was like, how on earth did they deal with the inflammatory aftermath of the imiquimod? But the study handily answered that question with that 2-month recovery period. And then after that period of time, they did the conservative staged excision. If patients had an inadequate inflammatory response to the imiquimod, they were treated also with topical tazarotene 0.1% gel twice weekly. The conservatively staged excisions began with 2 millimeter margins and went on from there if they needed to for further histologic cure. And so in this study, they had 235 men, 70% of their patients, and 99 women composing 30% of their patients. They were around 67 years of age at the mean with a standard deviation of 13 years. The patients were treated with imiquimod for a mean of 2.5 months prior to their staged excision. In this population, there were 12 local recurrences, so 12 out of 334 recurrences, a rate of 3.9%, with a mean time to recurrence of 4.3 years and a mean length of follow-up of 5.5 years. So in this study, they were able to determine that neoadjuvant topical 5% imiquimod cream prior to conservatively staged excisions for LM allowed for negative histologic margins with a median final margin of 2 millimeters and a recurrence rate similar to reported recurrence rates for standard staged excisions with either Mohs or ONFOS permanent sections. And ONFOS just means that you would prepare the histologic section of the margin as you are looking at it facing you so that you're able to assess the entire breadth of the margin that is facing the patient's tissue that still exists in the patient, so the closure. This was very interesting how they kind of came to do this study. When they were looking at the group of lentigo maligna specifically, as we know, this is something that happens typically in older patients on the head and neck in areas of chronic UV radiation exposure. It can progress from lentigo maligna, which is in situ disease, to invasive disease or lentigo maligna melanoma, but it does usually take quite some time for that to happen in most patients. Because of this, there's the perception that lentigo maligna is less dangerous of a skin cancer than other types of melanoma. However, if you adjust for Breslow thickness, lentigo maligna melanoma has the same likelihood of metastasis as other melanoma subtypes. And so you do have to treat these things as melanoma and take them seriously. In the United States, we tend to treat lentigo maligna surgically. Radiotherapy is more commonly used in Europe, Australia, and New Zealand. Because in surgery, it usually takes large margins to clear these lesions, you can end up with significant cosmetic defects. The 5 millimeter margins that are still used in some areas are based off of the 1992 consensus statement from the National Institutes of Health. However, that can allow for significant rates of recurrence, and published rates of recurrence for lentigo maligna following wide local excision with those margins range from 8 to 20%. Many academic institutions in the United States use a staged surgical technique such as Mohs with immunostaining, or the square or polygonal excisions that allow for ONFOS examination with permanent or frozen section assessment. When you do frozen sections, you do need to typically include immunostains because freezing leads to artifacts that can make it difficult to interpret for melanocytic presence. So you can have bloating, you can have vesicle formation within the epidermis because of freeze artifact that might obscure or confound the detection of melanocytes. So the immunostaining can be very helpful. The staged surgical approaches have lower rates of local recurrence, ranging from 0 to 9.7% versus 8 to 20% for conservative excision with traditional margins. But multiple stages can be required, and an average requirement of 7.1 millimeter margins were found to be necessary in the literature to confirm negative histologic results. These are large surgical margins and can increase cosmetic penalty, which is something they use in the article to discuss what happens when we treat patients for lentigo malignant. I think it is an appropriate term. So the cosmetic penalty can be significant because of these large margins that we need. Imiquimod is a nucleoside analog, so that is its kind of class of medication, of the imidazoquinone family with anti-tumor activity that has potentially three different pathways. The one we all think of first is that it's an agonist for toll-like receptors 7 and 8. So this results in activation of NF-kappa beta and the production of pro-inflammatory cytokines. It's also possible that imiquimod interferes with adenosine receptor pathways and increases adenylate cyclase activity. And it may also have pro-apoptotic activity against tumor cells. 5% imiquimod cream has been used off-label to treat lentigo maligna, both as a primary agent as well as adjuvant therapy following wide local excision with positive or narrow clear margins. When it's used as a primary agent, imiquimod has been reported to leave residual tumor cells in 25% to 53% of cases. So for me, I turn to topical imiquimod to treat lentigo maligna more as a palliative measure if patients are inappropriate surgical candidates or if they want to, if they're very excessively concerned about cosmesis and understand the risks. The caution has to be used, of course, when you're using imiquimod as monotherapy because it does have relatively significant rates of residual tumor cells. In this practice in Utah, it was their practice to use imiquimod as a neoadjuvant, so prior to staged excision, to help reduce the size of required surgical margins to confirm the negative histologic findings. So they used previously a cohort of 40 patients treated with topical imiquimod followed by conservatively staged excisions beginning with 2 millimeter margins. In that study, these authors found no recurrences after a mean follow-up of 1.5 years. They also had a randomized prospective trial of neoadjuvant topical imiquimod with or without tazarotene prior to conservatively staged excision with no recurrences after a mean follow-up of 3.5 years. So they had good data to base upon their recommendation to do the neoadjuvant therapy. In this institution in Utah, the previous study showed that 16% of lentigo maligna cases referred for treatment were actually invasive disease when full excision was performed. And that same percentage was also reported in the literature by Hazan et al. And that's relatively consistent with other studies in the literature. So many times when you biopsy lentigo maligna, you do a sampling biopsy because it's a large lesion on the face of a patient. So very large biopsies can be disfiguring, and you want to be certain that you're not going to leave a very large scar for something that might just be a lentigo or seborrheic keratosis. Complicating this further, we know that other studies have shown en bloc resections of lentigo maligna typically show lentigo maligna surrounded by seborrheic keratoses and solar lentigines. Taking that into account, along with a propensity to biopsy the periphery of the lesion, because a light spot in the middle of a dark spot is much more eye-catching than a light spot at the periphery of a dark spot, all of these things may contribute to the phenomenon where we don't detect the invasive melanoma on the original biopsies for lentigo maligna. So this is always the possibility when you're treating LM and has to be considered, unless the LM was diagnosed by a complete excisional biopsy, where you have all of the tissue to review. So I think all of those things are important to consider in the background of this study. When they did the treatment for these patients, if they found lentigo maligna melanoma in their biopsies, which they did after they did the neoadjuvant therapy, so the patients referred to them, they started the neoadjuvant therapy. After that was completed, if there was still clinical evidence of lentigo maligna, they completed an excisional biopsy to ensure that there was not invasive disease. And if invasive disease was found, it was treated with standard excision margins. So those patients were removed from this pool. So only disease that responded to imiquimod or was proven by excisional biopsy to be only lentigo maligna or melanoma in situ lentiginous type were included. So after the 2 to 3 months of 5 nights a week application of imiquimod, they had a 2-month waiting period to allow the skin to heal and those inflammatory changes to resolve. Following this, they did conservative staged excision starting with 2 millimeter margins and then proceeded from there. Now in episode 97, Luke, of Dermosphere, you may recall that we discussed that treatment delays in melanoma can increase morbidity and mortality. So you have to consider whether we determine the imiquimod as a treatment, and therefore this is not really a delay in therapy, or if we have to account for that. I think that under the circumstances of this trial and with the results that they produced, this looked like a safe pathway to do this by. But anytime you do delay melanoma definitive therapy, you have to consider the possibility that you might be worsening morbidity from the melanoma itself.
Well, this looks pretty good. We reduce the margins required to clear this lentigo maligna. We leave people with smaller scars. They have a smaller surgery. Is this something you guys are doing? Or I obviously don't do surgery for melanomas. Not this kind of melanoma.
You know, this is not a typical practice at our institution as a neoadjuvant. We often use it as adjuvant therapy following the staged excision if we have narrow margins or if we have concern. A lot of places kind of do it as a habit, which I think is fine if there's not a contraindication to doing that. I think that there's some good data that comes out of this. The recurrence rates were lower than for standard excision. They didn't have any severe outcomes with this. Interestingly, they did have a trend toward greater recurrence in patients that required the tazarotene to adequately respond to the imiquimod over patients who responded to the imiquimod without the tazarotene. And that may actually indicate something about the quality of the host immune response to the tumor itself. So that was one of the interesting points that they brought forth from the article.
The tazarotene, I didn't 100% understand. It looks like if they felt that the patient wasn't getting enough inflammation from the imiquimod, maybe it was because the imiquimod wasn't penetrating well enough into the skin. So the tazarotene was added to disrupt that barrier and allow the imiquimod to get in there better.
I think that was potentially part of it. For some patients with excessively sun-damaged skin, you'll see a lot of hyperkeratosis on it. And I do think that sometimes that hyperkeratosis may prevent penetration of therapeutic agents such as imiquimod. The tazarotene as an exfoliating agent may ameliorate some of that. But it was very interesting to me that the patients that didn't have an adequate response to the imiquimod potentially might have had a greater recurrence rate. Interestingly, also, a lot of their patients, 81% of the cohort, had clear margins after one stage of the staged excision. In 18% of the patients, there was residual tumor with adequate surrounding margins. So there was a pretty significant response, it seems, to the imiquimod. They did discuss the fact that because there might be residual tumor that was not clinically evident on physical exam, it might not be possible to determine whether or not there's tumor clearance without tumor sampling. So the utilization of imiquimod as monotherapy is not terribly dependable. And that's been my experience as well. So I think that it's something that can be used as neoadjuvant or adjuvant therapy, but only as monotherapy in exceptional circumstances. But I thought they did a very nice job of demonstrating their proof of concept. And this is something that I look forward to reading more about in the future.
Why do we have to read more about it? Can't we just do it? Seems pretty good. I mean, randomized controlled trials would be better, but I feel like this is pretty strong data.
I think it's data that is operable and actionable and something that could certainly be utilized. If you are going to use conservative excision, you do have to, I think, ensure that there's resolution of the inflammation, because the inflammation that can be caused after topical imiquimod can be an obscuring problem in dermatopathology. And melanocytic hyperplasia, which is typically rampant in patients that have lentigo maligna and have the chronic sun exposure to make that, can be sometimes confounded with inflammatory changes. And so I do think that waiting period or cooling off period after the therapeutic goal has been reached is reasonable and appropriate. And of course, appropriate to inform the patient about the risks of delaying therapy versus this protocol. But the patients did very well in this cohort, so I'm very excited about the data.
Well, I can't come up with a segue for this, except that both these articles are from JAMA Dermatology. But this next article is about children with TNF inhibitor-induced psoriasiform eruptions. And the title is Paradoxical Psoriasiform Eruptions in Children Receiving Tumor Necrosis Factor Alpha Inhibitors. Authors again include some heavy hitters in the world of pediatric dermatology: Joshua Eichstad, Amy Poller, Kelly Cordoro, and Megha Tollefson, for example.
Excellent.
So this is a big multi-center retrospective review of these TNF inhibitor-induced psoriasiform eruptions in children. So they found about 100 patients who were being treated for non-dermatologic issues. The vast majority were inflammatory bowel disease, over 90% of them. And they did find cases with a variety of TNF inhibitors, including infliximab, adalimumab, and sertolizumab. 60% of the patients were able to be controlled with just topical medications. Though it took about 6 months. That's probably the biggest takeaway. So if you do have a patient who has one of these eruptions, probably they can still continue their medication if it's working for their other disease, and you can just treat topically. Though some of their patients in this study received adjunct systemic therapy with adjunct. We know what that means. Helper systemic therapy with methotrexate, systemic steroids, or azathioprine. But in total, 2/3 of patients were able to continue their initial TNF inhibitor. The other third were switched. Two of them were switched to ustekinumab, and that was fine. They didn't have a relapse of this psoriasiform eruption. And the others were switched to some alternative TNF inhibitor. This worked most of the time. About 2/3 of the time, their psoriasiform eruption went away and didn't come back. But in about 1/3 of patients, the eruption developed again with the new drug. So I think there's a lot about the pathomechanism that's still unclear. And while most cases occurred with inflammatory bowel disease, they did find cases associated with other conditions as well. The phenomenon does not seem to have a gender or ethnic predilection, and the overall prevalence in kids on TNF inhibitors looks like it's about 7%. In over 90% of patients who developed the condition, their primary disease was under pretty good control with the TNF inhibitor, and the eruption appeared a median of 15 months after initiation of the drug. So it takes a while to show up, and it can show up even if your disease is under control. And in those who did recur on a second TNF inhibitor, it occurred more swiftly after about 6 months rather than 15 months. Though part of me wondered if that was due to increased vigilance by parents, patients, and healthcare professionals. About 18 of these 100 patients had persistent skin disease related to this psoriasiform eruption, prompting them to discontinue their TNF inhibitors altogether, and in some cases discontinue all systemic therapy. So that's kind of a bummer.
Yeah.
That's it. Some decent data. This retrospective review. I have had certainly a few patients who have had this issue, and generally I feel like I can control them with topical medications, but especially in situations where you think maybe not, you can talk to their GI doctor or their rheumatologist and say, yeah, well, you could try switching them to another TNF inhibitor and there's a decent chance it won't come back, or maybe you can think about a different biologic or some other treatment for their condition.
I've run into this a couple of times with golimumab. That particular medication, Simponi is its brand name, has an interesting tendency to produce psoriasis pustulosa, so sudden eruptive pustular psoriasis flares that create these large, like, pustulo-ulcerative lesions and can be very difficult to manage. It's so fascinating, the TNF axis, when it gets manipulated, how haywire it can go.
Yeah, do you know anything more about the pathomechanism of this phenomenon than I do? Because I'm just like, well, I guess you're messing with molecules, and occasionally they do things you don't expect.
It's a great question. Honestly, the research I've done in this as well does not really elucidate a specific mechanism for any particular agent. It seems to just be imbalancing that inflammatory axis that kind of creates the possibility for it. But it's very interesting. And it's interesting how some of them are more prone to make pustular eruptions, some are more prone to make psoriatic alopecia, and some are more prone to make atypical cutaneous psoriasiform lesions.
Is there a good way to remember that? I want to do something to increase my memory.
You know, if you want to think about memory, we could talk about memantine, which is a drug that we use by the brand name of Namenda to treat dementia patients, but it may have a new use. Spoiler alert. So this is an article outside of our literature from the Psychiatry Online org journal, and this is entitled
American Journal of Psychiatry, I think.
American Journal of Psychiatry sounds better. Double-blind placebo-controlled memantine in trichotillomania and skin picking disorder by chief authors John Grant and Samuel Chamberlain. The trichotillomania and skin picking disorders are under-recognized and understudied. They can be disabling, and they cause patients to repetitively pull at or pick at their hair or skin, creating noticeable cosmetic damage. There's a paucity of evidence for treatments for these patients. In this study, the authors are actually looking at memantine, which is a glutamate modulator, and were able to determine that it was more effective than placebo in reducing hair pulling and skin picking behavior. They had 100 adults with trichotillomania or skin picking disorder, 86% of which were women, average age of about 31 years, in this double-blind trial of memantine dosed from 10 to 20 milligrams per day or placebo for 8 weeks. The participants were assessed with numerous measures I'm not going to delve into too much detail about because they're more psychiatrically relevant than they are dermatologically relevant. But generally, they're measurements of the degree of impairment that the condition causes for the patient, the amount of distress that it causes or functional impairment, and the patient's ability to interfere with the impulse behavior of either pulling the hair or picking at the skin. So they looked at this with numerous different measures and were able to determine that there was significant improvement. About 60.5% of patients in the memantine group were much or very much improved, compared with only 8% in the placebo group. So the number needed to treat to give improvement was only about 2 patients, which is a pretty low number needed to treat for a therapeutic that's as benign and inexpensive as memantine is. So in the memantine treatment arm, there was a statistically significant reduction in hair pulling or skin picking symptoms compared with placebo, with relatively high efficacy and very good tolerability. So the glutamate system may be a target for the treatment of compulsive behaviors. And I was wondering if this might also be something beneficial to look at for patients that have delusions of parasitosis or prurigo nodularis with skin picking. So I think that this might be expanded into other areas of dermatology. The primary treatment for trichotillosis or skin picking disorder at this time is behavioral therapy. And there have been controlled studies on things such as habit reversal, which has 4, or if it's simplified, 3 components that involve sensitization and awareness. So rising to the awareness that there are signals or behaviors or environments that stimulate the behavior to occur. Like, I'm getting stressed, my hands are on my hair, I'm about to pull my hair, getting that sort of awareness piece there. And then creating a competing response. And the competing response is an alternate activity that is incompatible with the habit. So for example, with hair pulling, one of the competing responses that patients can use is to make their hand a fist and to put it on their side, because you cannot pull your hair if your hand is in a fist and on the side of your body. So finding an alternative activity to do with the part of the body that you're predisposed to have that repetitive unwanted behavior. And then habit control motivation or generalization training, which can be simplified into social support, having a family member or somebody in their social sphere help the patient to become aware of the behavior and to help remind them to engage their competing response. So those are kind of some of the tenets of typical treatment at this time. Acceptance enhanced behavior therapy is a combination of this habit reversal treatment along with stimulus control, which means to decrease the environmental variables that increase the likelihood of the behavior you're trying to decrease. So if people are more likely to bite their nails when they're watching television, then changing that behavior. And then acceptance behavioral therapy is accepting the life experiences as they come to you without trying to judge them. So teaching the patients to be non-judgmental of this behavior. This is something that may actually even have neurobiological motivation behind it. Interestingly, in this study, they looked at some MRI studies and were able to determine that there were some white matter changes that suggested disorganization of white matter tracts in the motor habit generalization in the motor tracts. So the patients might have actual white matter changes that contribute to these behaviors that could potentially be modified by controlling the glutamate pathway. And in animal data, they have some models where they have mice that have knockouts. It's SAPAP3 knockout mice, but they have a atypical compulsive grooming behavior. And the SAPAPs are proteins that act between glutamate receptor binding proteins and the cytoskeleton. So in these knockout mice, glutamate modulation was able to decrease the compulsive grooming behavior, giving some sort of basic science support that this might actually be beneficial. So that was one of the reasons that memantine was looked at as a potential therapeutic agent. I thought that that was kind of an interesting fact. Now, memantine has not been studied in pregnancy, so the patients they included in this study had to be on appropriate contraception to avoid the possibility of an affected pregnancy. When they looked at these patients, they had some baseline comorbidities, which are not unexpected in a patient that has a compulsive behavior. So in both the placebo and the experimental group, about 60% of patients had at least one co-occurring disorder, including major depressive disorder, anxiety disorder, or PTSD. Many of them were also undergoing psychotherapy in both the experimental and the control groups. Interestingly, the psychosocial comorbidities were more severe in the patients that were in the treatment group. So that was a harder group to achieve benefit in, but they still outperformed the placebo group. So I think that's good evidence that the patients actually did achieve improvement. Dropout rates were similar between both groups, indicating a likelihood that side effects were not motivating patients to stop using the medication. Dizziness was the only side effect that was isolatable to the active therapy. When patients were looked at by all these numerous psychiatric scales that are very important in their literature, and I have great respect for them, but will not delve into detail, they were able to find meaningful improvement in four of them, all of which assessed the presence of the behaviors and the impact of the behaviors on the patient's life. They did have some patients that had severe scores on the scale, the NIM scale. NIM is National Institutes of Mental Health, which is the organization from the rats of NIM. Theoretically, it was a fictional organization in that particular work from 1971, but it has got the exact same name and basically does the same thing. So I don't know if it really, really was fictional or if they were just hippies mad about rats getting experimented on.
That was a creepy movie.
That movie gave me such bad nightmares. But even patients who had the most severe scores on this NIM scale, indicative of severe illness, had 75% response rate to memantine. So that was a pretty significant improvement, even in the most severely impacted patients. And, you know, there's evidence in our literature also that the glutamate pathway may be impacted because we have previously published data about N-acetylcysteine and its efficacy in helping reduce the behaviors of trichotillosis. We discussed the use of N-acetylcysteine way back. Hold on, I'm trying to find my first page where I have this.
Yeah, it was a long time ago.
Episode 8 of Dermosphere, where we found in that article that 1,200 to 2,400 milligrams per day of N-acetylcysteine was beneficial in reducing compulsive behavior such as trichotillosis in dermatology patients. And so the treatment, memantine has also been studied in the treatment of obsessive compulsive disorder and has been found to be helpful in augmenting first-line interventions in those disorders. There was also no evidence of harm in this study in the patient experimental group, and the effect size for memantine was 1.76, which is comparable to the standard behavioral therapy that's typically used in those patients and superior to things such as olanzapine and clomipramine, which only had effect sizes of 0.94, 0.69. N-acetylcysteine, which has been found to be beneficial, had an effect size of 1.05. So memantine appears that it would be potentially more therapeutically efficacious for patients that have trichotillosis or skin picking disorder. I think that this was well-presented evidence that this could be a beneficial medication for these patients. Of course, you have to consider the potential side effects of any drug that you're utilizing to treat something. Memantine has a relatively benign side effect profile. The most serious side effect is dizziness, the most common side effect is dizziness. It can also cause bloating, can cause headache, nervousness, can cause weight loss or gain. Patients need to be assessed for any kind of disruptive side effect, but there's no evidence of long-term danger in taking the medication, and it can be used for many, many years in patients with its primary indication of dementia without evidence of harm. They usually stop Namenda or memantine in patients with dementia if the side effects are outweighing the benefits, which is, you know, how we should manage most medications. But I thought that this was very promising, and I think that there are other areas of dermatology that this could potentially be beneficial in.
It's also cheap.
Mm-hmm.
I looked it up and found the most expensive number for a month's supply was $90, and the least expensive was $3 for a month's supply of this stuff. So do I feel comfortable enough that I can just prescribe this tomorrow and say, hey, there was this cool article. It looks like a pretty safe drug. It's pretty cheap. Give it a try. I've never prescribed it. I almost never have thought about it. Do you feel like you've got a pretty good handle on the side effects and feel like, yeah, they're safe enough, I can just go ahead and do this?
I actually have a plan with this that I want to cautiously step into the world of utilizing this for some of my patients that already have a psychiatrist as a part of their care, and discuss the appropriateness of the therapy with that psychiatrist, ensure there won't be any interactions with any of their psychotherapeutics, and kind of co-treat them together to ensure there's no destabilization of any kind of coexisting neurologic or psychiatric disorder. But I actually think that the safety behind this is pretty reputable. And, you know, trichotillosis and skin picking can, in some patients, be relatively debilitating behaviors. So I think it's something that bears further investigation.
That's a good idea. And even patients who don't have a mental health provider, maybe you can just talk to their PCP. I bet PCPs know a lot more about this than I do. I don't know about pediatricians. I'm guessing they don't do it very often. But if it's sometimes used for OCD and stuff, then maybe.
Mm-hmm. I think it's a very interesting concept. And the glutamate axis and the fact that there might be actual white matter changes makes sense as to why something like N-acetylcysteine would be beneficial as well. So I think that the existing evidence supports the hypothesis that the glutamate axis might be out of order in these patients.
I thought N-acetylcysteine worked by scavenging free radicals, which were somehow a problem.
It does do that, but there is some effect on the glutamate axis as well. I don't know if we have time to delve into the deep.
We probably don't. I'm willing to take your word for it.
Okay.
All right. Well, that is probably all the time we have today, guys. So thank you so much for joining us. So today we learned that you should be careful about those UV lamps in nail salons. We learned about cantharidin for molluscum, now approved, but very expensive. On the plus side, looks like it works. I mean, better than placebo anyways. We learned about neoadjuvant imiquimod for lentigo maligna, especially with staged excisions. We learned about TNF inhibitor-induced psoriasiform eruptions in children. Hopefully you can treat through with topicals. And I always mispronounce it, I guess. Memantine can potentially be helpful for people who pick at their skin or hair. Mm-hmm. Thanks to our institutions, thanks to the University of Utah for supporting the podcast, and thanks to Texas Tech for lending us Michelle. Thanks also to the members of Team Dermosphere who do a whole lot to help keep this moving along. Thanks to Morgan Dykeman, Guy Kusecki, Eleonora Marcacci, Michael Birdsall, and Lara De La Cruz. Sorry, I was doing that off the top of my head. One thing you guys do is keep our social media accounts moving along. So you can find us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. You can also find us on our website, dermospherepodcast.com, which has links to all of the original articles we discussed, and it also has our entire archive. Any of these ways are good ways to reach out to us and say hello. Thanks again for hanging out with us today, listeners. And we'll see you in 2 weeks.